listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Reveal. In 1988, two powerful explosions shook Kansas City, Missouri, killing 6 firefighters. 9 years later, 5 people were convicted of arson and sent to prison for life. But were they innocent? Reveal investigates problems in the case and whether federal agents pressured witnesses to lie, as one of the defendants will soon make his case for freedom before a federal judge. That's coming up tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, in President Trump's first week in office, he signed an executive order reinstating the Mexico City rule, or as critics call it, the global gag order.
The order was signed by President Reagan in 1985. It restricts foreign aid organizations which receive U.S. funding from providing or promoting abortions to women. Furthermore, it limits what doctors are able to talk about when it comes to abortions and family planning.
Rachel Robinson joins us now. She's an associate professor in the School of International Service at American University. Rachel, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, bring us up to speed on this executive order. How broad is it, and what exactly does this order do?
Sure. Well, as your little intro there suggested, it makes it much harder for non-U.S. organizations to do anything related to counseling or mentioning abortion as a possible outcome for women. That's sort of the way that the policy has been in the past. What's new this time around with Trump's reinstatement of the policy is that the sort of conditionality that organizations have to agree to has been extended much further. So before, organizations just had to say that they wouldn't use any of their funding, be it U.S. or not, to quote-unquote perform or actively promote abortion as a method of family planning. If they failed to do that, then they would lose their U.S. family planning assistance. Now they're at risk of using all of their U.S. global health assistance, so whether it's for HIV/AIDS or maternal and child health or family planning as before.
Take us back to the mid-1980s, the Reagan administration, when this Mexico City rule came to be. How it was perceived then and over the administrations, how it's perceived now?
Sure. So it was originally instated by President Reagan during the International Conference on Population, which was held in Mexico City, hence the name. There's no other connection beyond that. And it was very much the result of abortion politics in the U.S. But it was also facilitated by Reagan's very active dislike of the United Nations. So implementing the policy sort of took the U.S. off the hook for its contribution in particular to the United Nations Population Fund. The policy then stayed in place throughout the presidency, the rest of Reagan's presidency, and then through George H.W. Bush. It was rescinded by Clinton, then put back in place by George H. Bush, and then rescinded again by Obama in 2009. And so it's come to be highly symbolic of U.S. abortion politics, to the extent that Obama was even criticized for not rescinding it fast enough after he came to office in 2009.
How have countries around the world been impacted? How has healthcare been impacted?
Well, the best research that we have at this point indicates a really chilling and negative effect on health. So in particular, research conducted by Aran Ben David and colleagues at Stanford has demonstrated that in those sub-Saharan African countries that are particularly reliant on U.S. funding for family planning, there was actually a link in the 2000s between the decrease in access to contraceptive services that occurred because of the policy and then an increase in abortions. So abortions actually increased.
And does any U.S. aid actually pay for abortions?
No, and that has been the case since the 1973 Helms Amendment to the U.S. Foreign Assistance Act. So that has long been off the table. So opponents of the Mexico City policy often argue that it sort of goes above and beyond what's already written into law.
So how much of this is about politics, about abortion politics, in your opinion?
Pretty much all of it. it's hard if the justification is to reduce abortions and then research shows that that's not the case. It becomes very difficult to justify the policy.
As you look around the globe, how are NGOs reacting? How are physicians, health workers moving forward in this situation?
Well, as the history sort of indicates, this is something that, most of these people and organizations they're familiar with. And it was absolutely expected that this was going to happen under the Trump administration, and it would have happened, you know, any Republican presidency. The thing that these organizations and people have to deal with is essentially a lot of uncertainty. And so at this point right now, most of the uncertainty is really about what this further provision of the policy means. So by extending it to all global health assistance and not just family planning. But the uncertainty is really, it has damaging effects. So the policy just, it makes the funding environment unknown. So organizations are often not sure if their activities would actually make them ineligible for funding, or if the funding that they're receiving from another organization might actually have come from the U.S. And so as a result, they will err on the side of caution when the policy is in effect, thus, you know, potentially reducing services and sometimes unnecessarily. And so my sense is that, you know, this particular effect of the policy might actually, unfortunately, be greater this time around.
Do we have any hard data out there that shows this policy is reducing the number of abortions around the world?
Not to the best of my knowledge, no. The one study from Ben David et al. From 2011 just showing the increase in abortions.
We're speaking with Rachel Robinson right now about the Mexico City rule, which was reinstated by President Trump in his first week in office. She's an associate professor in the School of International Service at American University.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this Mexico City rule? What role do you think the United States should be playing in providing foreign aid? And should abortion or even talk about abortion be off the table for groups getting aid from the United States? How about family planning and foreign funding of that by the U.S.? Give a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're continuing our conversation about President Trump's decision to reinstate the Mexico City rule, which prevents any foreign aid organization receiving U.S. money from not only performing abortions, but advising women on abortions. We're speaking with Rachel Robinson. She's associate professor in the School of International Service at American University.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with the president's decision to reinstate this Mexico City rule, the gag rule, as critics call it? What do you think about the political back and forth with each change of party in the White House? The rule is rescinded or put back in place. Do you have questions about this Mexico City rule, what it means for doctors and their patients around the world? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, Rachel, women are still getting abortions illegally in many cases. How might this order affect how doctors provide post-abortion care?
Yeah, that's another big unanswered question. So in the past, post-abortion care, the so-called care that women receive in the event that they've had an abortion and perhaps, you know, something has gone wrong, or they just need family planning services. In the past, there's been sort of an explicit statement that that is still acceptable. That it's not clear at this point whether that will still be the case. And so that cuts off a major avenue of care for women. And, you know, deaths due to unsafe abortions are a major cause of maternal mortality the world over. So this has ramifications, beyond sort of the abortion element of it. If we're serious about reducing maternal mortality, there needs to be post-abortion care.
Yeah, what are the repercussions here beyond abortion? The health issues like HIV/AIDS, cervical cancer, child health. What's the ripple effect?
Yeah, so family planning saves lives. It helps reduce maternal mortality by preventing pregnancy that occurs, you know, too early, too late, or too close together. And that those are the sort of three areas that really increase the risk for women. But it turns out those are the same factors that are associated with infant mortality as well. So there's, you know, very direct links through family planning. And then in addition, it turns out that, you know, providing family planning to women who are HIV positive is one of the main means of preventing mother-to-child transmission of HIV. So, of course, women who are HIV positive have the exact same rights as everyone else if they wish to have children, but many of them, you know, do not. And so ensuring that they're able to prevent pregnancy as well is a major pathway through preventing infant transmission of HIV.
Let's bring in Steve from La Crosse. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Yes, thanks for taking my call. This just seems so counterintuitive for anybody who cares about world health or family planning or population. And I just really appreciate you bringing it up. It sort of got lost, it seemed like, in all the flurry of presidential documents that have been released the last couple of weeks. So thank you so much.
Well, Steve, while you're with us, what is it about this executive order that you are really concerned about women's health around the globe?
Just giving low-income women access to health care is just so important, and especially child health, you know.
And Rachel, in terms of child health and in terms of spreading out pregnancies, what impact might these dollars have on that?
It starts to get a little hard to tell at that point, right? So those, you know, there is still funding at this point from the U.S. going towards family planning. We are one of the major supporters of family planning the world over. I think the most recent year it was about $600 million worth of assistance. And so that money per se, you know, a huge percentage of it should hopefully not be at risk. So we are still making major contributions to those areas. It's really through these more indirect pathways, should organizations, local organizations, local doctors, people working in country who are somehow reliant on U.S. funding, either directly or indirectly, should they change their behavior, either because, you know, they still wish to be able to counsel women on topics related to abortion, or just because they're concerned about losing their funding, then that's where the sort of really negative ramifications might come into play.
And meanwhile, organizations like Refugees International has put forth this coalition statement on opposing it with more than 140 signatories. What do we know about some of the opposition going on around the world?
That is a topic with which I am less familiar with, mm-hmm. but in general, I can say, you know, these coalitions do form every time that the global gag rule or Mexico City policy is put into place. And one of the amazing things that happens, and I think this speaks to some of the strength of the international community, is that when there is a shortfall in U.S. funding, other governments do their best to try to pick up the slack. And so it's often the Nordic countries, so the Scandinavians and the Norwegians and the Dutch.
We heard the Danish government stepping up, I think I read.
Yeah, and it shouldn't have to be that way in some regards, but I think it speaks to the fact that the global reproductive health community is particularly strong because it has, you know, been under attack, I think, at so many points in the past. And so that network, you know, comes to the fore and does what it can.
Thanks, Steve, for your call. Let's go to Ben in La Crosse. Hi, Ben.
Hi. My comment has to do with the effects of reducing women's access to reproductive care. There are many experts that have pointed out that issues of global warming, mass migrations and immigration, refugees, the disparity of access to resources and income levels, and a number of different world crises issues are related directly to human population levels. So any policy that reduces women's access to reproductive care exacerbates those problems, those larger problems. Thank you.
Rachel?
Yes, the issue of population size and how it links to women's reproductive health, there have been many arguments used, you know, over the 20th century and into the 21st century, and it's a very malleable topic. Starting from the 1990s onwards, you know, one of the most potent arguments was in terms of improving women's reproductive rights and that would have beneficial impacts on socioeconomic development. But we've seen a rise, as the caller indicated, in terms of possible implications for global warming and maybe refugee crises, these types of things. I think the most important message at the end of the day is that there are widespread and multifaceted connected benefits to ensuring that all people can determine the number and timing of their children.
But looking at the other side here, a moment here, there's a strain of thought that the U.S. should pull foreign aid altogether and focus on more domestic issues. Why do you think that people should care about this?
Well, I think that they should care about it for the same reason that we should care about health prevention. And essentially, prevention is always the best option because it's more expensive to fix a problem after it already happens. So if Americans want to protect against future disease outbreaks that might start someplace else but come to our shores, and, you know, the two most recent examples of that are Zika and Ebola, we will do best if we invest in strengthening health systems in poor countries. And this policy is really a step in the wrong direction for doing that. As I show in my forthcoming book, Intimate Interventions in Global Health, it was precisely the local family planning organizations in sub-Saharan Africa who sort of were the first to respond to HIV. And so they didn't come into existence because of HIV. They didn't get funding from the U.S. or anyone else because of HIV. But they were a resource that was there, and they were a resource that was in contexts that were severely, you know, severely under-resourced. And so when we pull funding for things that may seem like they're not related to health or other issues, we really run the risk of having something further down the road that will be very damaging.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for joining us. That was Rachel Robinson, Associate Professor in the School of International Service at American University, talking about the Mexico City rule.